Tuesday, January 17th, the Infrequency Collective presents the Inner Retina Recital, lights out for this sonorous soiree celebrating Art's birthday and Vancouver's community radio station, CFRO 102.7 FM. The Inner Retina Recital takes place in complete obscurity. The audience will be seated in the dark to experience sound-based performances in a state of total visual sensory deprivation. The Inner Retina Recital happens January 17th, 8:30 p.m., 303 East 8th Avenue. Tickets are $5 at the door.
It's just 12 o'clock, and you are tuned to CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM. And it's time now for Animal Voices. We have some elephants going to do our opening song today for us. And then you'll hear endless wonders here from the world of animals here on Co-op Radio.
Welcome to Animal Voices. This is our first program for the year 2006. May this be a year filled with kindness for all species. Animal Voices is a weekly show produced through the cooperative efforts of three local groups, Earth Save Canada, Vancouver Humane Society, and Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection. The ideas expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the three cooperating groups. My name is Marge Adams, and today we're pleased to have our regular technician, Alan Jensen, back in the control room. Alan has just returned from a trip to South America, and he will be telling us about his visit to Peru later on in the show. In the studio with me is John Pranger of Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection, who will be presenting an informative reading. Now, first on the show is our friend Peter Fricker, who is with the Vancouver Humane Society, and he is their projects and communications coordinator. Peter will be telling us about Hazina, who is the baby hippopotamus at the Greater Vancouver Zoo. Her situation at present is not a very good one. So, Peter, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm here, Marge.
Oh, hi, Peter.
Hi there.
Nice to have you with us.
Thanks.
Peter, now you've been listening. I'm confused. Hazina, the baby hippo, has been at the Vancouver Zoo for over a year now. And will you tell us something about her conditions there?
Yes, that's right, Marge. I mean, I suppose the first thing to remember is that hippos are social animals. They're usually in the wild, in herds of sort of 10 to 15 hippos. And at Hazina's age, which is about two, in the wild, she would be with her mother. Now, she's been in this small concrete barn at the Greater Vancouver Zoo for over a year now, and she's been there all alone. So when you consider all that, it's a pretty poor situation to think that an animal that is that should be with other animals of its own species is being kept alone in a concrete barn on the west coast of Canada, when, of course, she should be in her native habitat.
Is that concrete barn a warm enclosure? Or?
It is heated, but it's very small, and it has a very small pool, about 8 by 8 feet, which she's rapidly outgrowing. And, of course, hippos need access to water and need to be submerged for a great deal of time in order to take pressure off their joints, because obviously they're an enormous weight. So we're very concerned about her psychological health and her physical health. We do know that the SPCA has launched an investigation into her condition, and that is ongoing. We've also asked the BC Minister of the Environment, Barry Penner, to look into Hazina's conditions. He did state on television a month or so ago that he would ask his officials to look into it, but since then we've received a letter from him stating that it's not the ministry's responsibilities, and of course we dispute that for the simple reason that the Ministry of Environment does issue permits to zoos and also has the power to designate animals as wildlife and give them the protection of the Wildlife Act, and that is what we're asking them to do, and unfortunately they now appear to be stalling on that and saying it's not their responsibility.
The Vancouver Zoo does not have Greater Vancouver Zoo does not have a very good reputation, does it, for the care and housing of animals? I think it has a history of problems with their animals.
That's right. Of course, if we look back to one of the most notorious cases was Tina the elephant, who was kept in very poor conditions for over 30 years before she was finally freed and transferred to a sanctuary, but her health suffered during the time she was there, and we're of course worried that this is a very similar situation with this lone baby hippo Hazina. They have promised on a number of occasions to build a new facility, and they have now told us that this facility is under construction and should be completed within 4 months. But even if that's the case, it's a very long time. By the time she gets there, she'll have been nearly a year and a half alone in this completely inappropriate facility, a concrete barn. And again, as I say, she's been there all alone. So even if they do complete that, we think that she may have suffered some psychological damage and possibly damage to her physical health as well.
Well, remember, Tina had a foot problem, didn't she, from being on the hard ground all the time? And I suppose hippos are very heavy animals. To be on concrete would be a very bad thing for her, wouldn't it?
Yes, I would think that would certainly be the case. And obviously, with Tina, that damage to her feet didn't occur until the latter stages of her life and was ultimately instrumental in her death a year or so later while she was at the sanctuary. So, you know, she may look fine now if you were to go and look at her, but who knows what damage may be caused by her conditions now further down the road.
There were other hippos at the Greater Vancouver Zoo, weren't there, previously?
That's right. In the zoo's history, going back to about 1983, they have had four hippos. And it's interesting and sad to note that all four of those hippos have died prematurely while there. Two died when they crashed through the ice on their pond in 1983 and drowned. And then they had two others later in the 1990s and up until about 2004. And during that period, those two hippos died from various infections. And they died early, about 20 years before they should have reached their age of about 40 in captivity, and they died in their 20s.
Now, I know the Vancouver Humane Society has been very concerned about zoo situations over the years. Mm-hmm. Are there other organizations that are also equally concerned, perhaps?
Yes, certainly Zoo Check Canada has been a great help to us in trying to bring this situation to the attention of the authorities, to the attention of the public and the media and so on, trying to raise the standards in zoos and in these particular cases, and most recently with Hazina.
Mm-hmm. What about the SPCA?
Well, the SPCA, as I say, has launched an investigation into Hazina's condition, and we're very pleased that they're looking into this. And obviously we'll have to wait and see what the outcome of the investigation is.
Well, they would have authority on the kindness aspects, wouldn't they?
Yes, under the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act in BC, it might be possible to lay charges of cruelty against an individual or an organization such as the zoo. It can be an awfully difficult case to make. They would need to prove that there had been abuse. And so it remains to be seen whether they'll be able to make a strong enough case to bring before the courts.
When Hazina was brought in over a year ago now, was there a public reaction to that?
Yes, I mean, we certainly raised this issue. You know, why are they bringing in a new hippo, a baby hippo, to a zoo when they don't have a proper facility built? It just, you know, is common sense that you'd think you'd have a facility first and then acquire these animals. I mean, of course, in principle, we're against animals being kept in captivity for entertainment purposes, but, you know, we recognize that this zoo does exist and these other zoos do operate, and if they're going to operate, they need to do so at the highest possible standard, and therefore, if they're going to have these facilities, they need to ensure that they're ready, that they're appropriate, and that they do as much as possible to replicate the conditions the animal would have in the wild. The Greater Vancouver Zoo has done none of these things.
And I wonder if they will confer with groups like VHS and ZooCheck about the facility. Have you been had any discussion at all with the zoo owners as to what they're going to build?
On a number of occasions, we have met with the zoo's owners, given them our opinions, and they have made these promises to us as late as last summer, that this facility would be completed very shortly. It was originally promised to be completed in October of 2004, and here we are in 2006, and it's still not ready. So, you know, we've certainly tried to have these discussions with them, but they just have not kept their promises.
Yes, and one would query, what do they have in mind as far as accommodation, and are they well informed about what hippos need, I wonder?
Well, we can only hope so. The plans we were shown for the new facility looked adequate in terms of, relative to other zoos. It looked like it might be a good facility. Of course, we don't know now whether they're going to complete it to those standards, whether corners will be cut, anything like that. They have promised to spend $500,000 on this facility, and we're hoping that if and when it is complete, that it's going to be a high standard facility and certainly better than what Hazina is in now.
I understand that TELUS has made Hazina famous. Could you tell us about that?
Yes. Over the last few months, TELUS, as I'm sure many people would have noticed, has been running an advertising campaign with animals and a hippo, which we learned late last year was indeed Hazina. We're very unhappy about TELUS using exotic and wild animals in their advertising campaign, and we have made our position known to them. We think that that kind of use of animals only perpetuates the captive animal industry. In addition to zoos, there are animal rental agencies, including some in the Vancouver area, that rent out animals for commercials and films and television and so on. And that's what they're kept for, and people are just exploiting them to make money. We've, protested and made that point to TELUS and asked them to stop using Hazina and other animals in their advertising. So far, we've had no response.
Mm-hmm. It's perfectly legal, I suppose, isn't it?
It is, unfortunately. There's absolutely no protection for exotic animals as to, the standards they're kept in. There are no written standards in British Columbia saying how an animal should be kept if it is an exotic and foreign animal. Only native species receive any sort of protection in that way.
Now, you alluded to this briefly earlier on in the interview about making the hippo bring her under the Wildlife Act.
That's right. As I say, the only native species in BC receive any kind of protection under the Wildlife Act, which is overseen by the Ministry of the Environment in BC. What we'd like to see is that kind of protection extended to exotic and foreign animals. So other captive animals, such as hippos, elephants, lions, tigers, all the kinds of things that have been imported or bred here and kept in captivity, we would like to see them designated as wildlife under the Wildlife Act, which is perfectly possible for the ministry to do. It's within their powers to designate any animal being held captive in BC as wildlife. If they were to do that, then those animals would automatically receive that protection that native species currently enjoy.
And that's under the Department of the Environment. Who is the minister?
is it's Barry Penner.
Is such a designation would have really wide implications, wouldn't it, for the importing, selling, and ownership of exotics?
That's right, because that would give the ministry the power to regulate and to protect those animals to some degree. They could, for example, go into any zoo and examine the standards at which a hippo or elephant or lion or tiger was being kept, and demand that those conditions be improved, subject to the permit that's been issued to the zoo. If the zoo did not meet those standards, then that permit could be withdrawn. So we would automatically have a means of ensuring that these animals are kept to a much better standard.
And we could prevent incidents of snakes getting into the plumbing system of an apartment building, for example. And that kind of thing does happen when exotics are not properly cared for.
There may be some regulation that could apply there. In the meantime, what's really important is that municipalities pass exotic animal bylaws to ensure that those kinds of large reptiles and other exotic animals are not sold or kept by private individuals.
Yeah, is there anything that you could suggest the public could do right now to help the hippo and maybe also get something moving on the exotics? Because that's a big issue, exotics.
Yeah, I mean, people can certainly make their views known to the Greater Vancouver Zoo, and obviously we encourage people to write letters to local media, that kind of thing, and simply make their views known about this issue as widely as they can.
And is there any way of getting more information on the issue that you could suggest?
You can certainly go to the VHS website. That's VancouverHumaneSociety.bc.ca, and there's more information there, and we'll try and keep it updated.
Well, thank you so much, Peter, for bringing us up to date on the hippo issue at the Greater Vancouver Zoo. We certainly appreciate you taking the time to do this.
And thanks much.
We're very hopeful something will be done.
Absolutely. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Peter Fricker, who is the Vancouver Humane Society Project and Communications Coordinator. Now, Alan, could we have a piece of music, please? Now we're going to be hearing from Alan Jensen, our technician and good friend of Animal Voices. He has just recently returned from a trip to Peru. And Alan, tell me, why did you decide to go to Peru at this time?
Oh, there's all kinds of reasons. It's a matter of deciding where you're going to go for a holiday, going somewhere warm. And I was in Peru once many, many years ago. My partner and I went down there many years ago and had thought of going back someday. It is such an interesting country. It is so full of different extremes of different sorts and different sorts of environments, different elements and so on, with the coastal strip, the desert strip, and then it rises very quickly up into the Andes, which are simply towering, this vast mountain range. And then you go over the top of the Andes and you're down into the Amazon basin. About half the country is actually in the Amazon. You don't think of that with Peru, but at least half the country is actually in the Amazon lowlands, which we didn't do on this trip. We were just on the coast and up in the mountains. The Amazon is a whole other world, and it takes a lot more preparation to get into.
So you flew into Lima, Peru,
yep.
I guess, didn't you?
Yep.
And did you spend most of your time right there? Or?
No. We flew into Lima one day and left the next. Went. So Lima's huge, I should say. The country has the problem of many underdeveloped countries, is there's one vast city that attracts all the people from the hinterland, and then you have a number of smaller towns and cities scattered throughout the country, and Peru is very similar to many countries in Latin America and Africa and other parts of the world. So Lima, the country maybe has 25 million people, and there's more than 8 million in Lima alone. So a third of the country is in this one city that's just growing like crazy all the time. There's people pouring in all the time. As parts of the countryside get overpopulated, people, you know, there's not much work in the countryside. People head for the city. So the city, though it's interesting in certain ways, has lots of problems, and it's not the most interesting place in the country. So, like I said, the next day we flew south to Arequipa. It was a 16-hour bus ride, so we decided at this point it would be better just to fly down to Arequipa rather than spend our first whole day on the bus, and then spend a few days in this. This is in the south center of the country.
Would you recommend Lima for a tourist to visit, or is that a place just to drop in and leave as you did?
Well, it depends. There are a couple of good museums. A little bit of the downtown has been restored, but really it's, you know, the problems are so huge that there isn't that many attractive areas to walk around in the center of town. There are some nice suburbs. You want to go down the south of the downtown area into the middle-class suburbs. It's very pleasant to walk around there, but that's walking around suburban, you know, areas, neighborhoods, which is it nice to do for an afternoon, maybe, and there's nice cafes and restaurants and things in the suburbs, but there's not a lot specifically to do in the city other than visiting a couple of museums and maybe walking around the main square.
I see. Looking at the map, I notice it's on the west coast, but maybe that's about as close to Vancouver in comparison as it gets, being on the west coast.
Yes.
It's a huge coastline, I guess. How many miles would it be?
Well, I mean, the whole country is a coastline, right? North, so it's a good 1,000 miles of mainly sandy beach, I mean, all the way down. There are some rocky sections, but given the nature of the country, like it's quickly rising out of the sea, which has resulted in largely sandy beaches all the way down the coast. It's a coastal desert strip, so it's a desert from pretty well from the north to south, and the further south you go, the drier it gets. It's very dry in the north, and it's even drier in the south. And in the south, where we were, south of Lima, maybe 100, 150 miles, it never rains at all. It just doesn't rain. It is, you know, it's as dry as you can get, which means there's a lack of vegetation. There are, I think, 10 or 11 small rivers that run from the mountains down to the coast in Peru. And those places are like oases as you travel south through the country. There are these areas where there are rivers, so there's vegetation and towns and so on. Lima is on one of these rivers. They're not very big rivers, but there's enough water to, you know, keep a population alive and grow a few vegetables and so on. But that's it otherwise.
Now, when you left Lima, you went south. And is that the time that you visited a national park?
No, that was later on. So that was the national park is down south on the coast, where we originally flew to Arequipa, which is inland a little ways in the south, south center. And Arequipa itself is a very pleasant town, but you're starting to get into the mountains at Arequipa, and there's an incredible area called the Colca River Valley and the Colca Canyon that is just near Arequipa, and we spent a few days going up into that area, which is a fascinating area both in terms of culture, the social situation that exists there, but also in terms of the geography, because the mountains are quite young in Peru. There hasn't been a lot of erosion going on, and so they're very big. The Andes are very big, towering mountains, and they're very stark and sheer. So there's lots of very deep canyons throughout the Andes. It's very spectacular country. Like British Columbia is pretty spectacular, but the Andes are twice as tall as the mountains in BC, and the valleys are much, much more deep. They're really canyons. They're really huge chasms that cut through the mountains throughout the country, and it's quite a spectacular drive up. It's often very hair-raising to drive in the different parts of the country, because these roads are kind of etched along the edge of these cliffs that go literally thousands and thousands of feet up, and you're in a little bus going along the edge of one of these cliffs where a little road has been etched along the side. But it's incredibly scenic. And the Colca Canyon is in one of these very spectacular areas. It's literally thousands of feet from the top to the bottom of the canyon. And speaking in terms of animals, one of the reasons we went there is because this is the best place probably anywhere to see condors, which is the world's biggest bird. And there's this one area called Cruz de Condor. It's a particular high point in the Colca Canyon where you can travel up to, and you're sitting on the edge and you're looking down more than 3,000 feet straight down. I mean, it's amazing. You're looking this vast distance down, way down below. There's the river, the bottom of the river valley, and you can see across the valley a few terraces where a few people live in this remote area. But in the morning, as the sun starts and warms up the valley down below, the condors, which nest and roost down there, they start to leave. And when it gets warm and the updrafts begin in the valley, then they can start circling up in the air. And you look way down, you see these little specks thousands of feet below as the condors leave and they start circling. Mm-hmm. And they start circling around and around. As it gets warmer, they can go higher and higher. And so within maybe half an hour or so, all of a sudden, they're starting to get quite close to you. And then pretty soon, they're right up to your level, and they're right there, right, going around. These huge birds, right, flying around, and then they go up above. And when they get up to a certain level above the canyon, then they will head north or south to go and look for their food for the day.
I see. And what an impressive sight it must be. They grow as they get up higher and higher.
Yeah, right. And you're in this incredible environment to begin with, this absolutely spectacular canyons, and then these huge birds sort of slowly wheeling around and getting higher and higher.
You get quite a change from the bottom to the top. You went up by bus, you were telling me. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that the scenery must change remarkably as far as vegetation,
yeah, it's
for
quite
example.
Fertile at the bottom. It's, you know, because of the river, and there's a little bit of rainfall at certain times of year there. It's quite fertile, but as you get up, you're going much higher in elevation. Like, we were over 16,000 feet. I mean, this is fairly high up, and not much grows when you get up to that high. It's too high, and that's actually too high for agriculture. People live up to maybe 14,000 in terms of growing potatoes and things like that. But and so you're way above the tree line, and it's pretty stark and bare.
The soil is probably
a few little shrubs and things.
Yeah, I see. There wouldn't be a lot of soil, maybe on rock.
Yeah, not rocky. Much.
No.
Yeah.
No.
So potatoes are indigenous to Peru?
Which?
Potatoes.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes.
How many varieties?
Many varieties. Peru had a very sophisticated indigenous culture, of course, before the Europeans came, and great numbers of foodstuffs originated. Well, like out of Mexico, of course, a lot of foodstuffs originated, but out of Peru also. It's quite amazing. Most people there still eat indigenous foods. I mean, in many ways, for many people, life hasn't changed since the Spanish arrived 500 years ago. They've been interfered with in a lot, and the Catholic Church has come along, and the Armada an army and that sort of stuff. But still, most people live in their villages growing the crops they grew hundreds of years ago, the potatoes and the corn and the peppers and other types of grains and beans of various types.
Squashes, maybe?
Hmm?
Bean squash and
corn. Yeah, squashes,
and corn.
Yep.
Traditional diet. And is that reflected in their physiques, too, do you think? Are they strong, healthy people?
Well, yeah. People who live at very high elevations tend to have somewhat different physiques just because they have to deal with the lack of oxygen. It takes us a little while to get used to, it takes you a long time. Mm-hmm. And it is reflected in the physiology of people, for sure.
Now, there are restrictions on people going into the mountains now that didn't exist a few years back. Could you tell us about that?
Well, it's actually looser now than it was a few years ago. Like, there was a guerrilla movement, the Sendero Luminoso, right, the Shining Path, that was very active for a number of years in parts of the country. But in the late 90s, they were pretty well eliminated. And so that's made a big difference in terms of the country's economy because it's allowed the tourist industry to open up again, which there was a big damper on the tourist industry because many tourists wanted to go into the mountains, but you simply could not. It was much too dangerous.
It was controlled, actually controlled by the Shining Path?
Yes. Parts of the country were. They were actually controlled. And then there was a civil war that went on for a number of years between the armed forces and Sendero Luminoso. And eventually Sendero Luminoso actually left the mountains largely and went down to Lima and conducted an urban battle in Lima for a few years in the 90s. But they were... Finally, I mean, it was inevitable. Yeah, they were in the end. They weren't going to win out. But they had a lot of support in highland villages because they're so depressed. There's a lot of very poor people in these little villages in the highlands. And the Sendero Luminoso promised them things, you know, promised them democracy, that they could run their own lives, that they wouldn't have to worry about the government, military, and the church, and so on, that they could. And so there was a receptive audience in some places.
I see. I was thinking of government regulations regarding having to have bears to go up into the mountains.
Well, no, that's only, as far as I know, if you want to hike to Machu Picchu.
Oh.
Like Machu Picchu, these amazing... archaeological remains of the Incas, this city up in the mountains, is probably the most significant tourist attraction in the country. Like, lots of people go to Machu Picchu. And some people want to... you can hike. There's an old Inca trail, a four-day hike you can do. Or you can take the train straight to Machu Picchu or to the base of the mountain where Machu Picchu is. Or you can hike for 4 days. You get off the train early and you hike for 4 days. And until a few years ago, you could just go and do it. But it got out of control. Too many people were showing up and not following the trail properly and getting lost and getting into trouble and littering the path. And so the government started regulating it. And so now you cannot just go by yourself. You have to go in a group. And you have to sign up, pay, go in a group, and then the group has leaders and it has bearers to carry your luggage and so on. And so it's made, it has been made into, a nice sort of little middle class sort of jaunt, as opposed to anything like a hike in the wilderness by any means. But, it was necessary to do that because there was just too many people going and there was no control over it. But that's the only place, as far as I know, where there's any real restrictions like that. I mean, there may be some other more remote parts of the country where they don't want foreigners to interfere with the villagers. And that, because that can be a problem in underdeveloped countries when you've got insensitive foreigners wandering into villages and interfering with the life of people. But that would be exceptional. The main thing I think you're referring to is people want to hike the Inca Trail, and now they have to pay substantially and go in a group.
Oh, yeah, I see. Now, so tourism is a big money maker for the country.
Yeah, totally,
and
yes.
It's important to keep it going, I guess.
Yeah, and that area, the valley, the Urubamba Valley that runs from Cuzco down to Machu Picchu, It's maybe, I don't know, 100 miles or something. And that's the heart of the Inca Empire. Cuzco was the capital of the Inca Empire. And Machu Picchu was this amazing citadel city they built at the north end of the Urubamba Valley. But that whole valley is incredible. There's Inca towns studded all the way through it, and fantastic stone terraces that go up the mountains on either side. And because of the amazing construction techniques of the Incas, all this still survives. I mean, they were so good at building out of stone that it just lasts forever. And one of the funny things is that when the Spanish came, of course, they built all their structures in the cities and in the towns. But all the Spanish buildings have fallen down because of earthquakes. But the Inca buildings are all still there, right?
Is that because of the way the stones have been cut?
Yeah, exactly.
So in the same megalithic style with these huge rocks also?
Yeah, and the Inca style did not use mortar or cement. The rocks are cut to perfectly fit one another. And so if there's an earthquake, it just kind of moves around, but it doesn't slide or fall apart. Whereas, of course, the Spanish style was to use cement and mortar to hold bricks together. And in an earthquake, that mortar will just kind of pulverize and the whole thing collapses. And a lot of the Spanish buildings were actually built on Inca foundations, so they would take an old Inca building and knock the top off it and build the Spanish building on the Inca walls. And the walls are still there, but the Spanish buildings would fall down.
Right? So there's a lot of archaeological sites that one can go and view that look to be without tops, I guess.
You're right, yeah. Yeah, the Spanish, of course, the Europeans who run the country since the Spanish left have generally not respected the archaeological legacy of the indigenous people very much. And they've tended to raid the archaeological sites and take the stones into the cities and build their own buildings out of these stones, right? And that does not happen anymore. Now the government has realized that there's a lot of money in tourism and it's better to leave these archaeological sites alone. But until recently, that was a big problem, the raiding of the sites for building materials.
Is the population largely Aboriginal people?
Yes. I'm not sure what the percentage is, but it's certainly well over 50% Aboriginal people, yeah.
And Spanish-speaking?
Yeah, well, many people in the highlands still speak Quechua. That's the lingua franca in the mountains is Quechua, which was the Inca language. And the Aymara, which is another native language, is spoken in the south down towards Lake Titicaca. And, of course, when you get into the Amazon area, like I said, half the country's in the Amazon basin. Well, there's a whole other family of languages down there. But in the mountains, Quechua is still widely spoken.
And do the Aborigines have equal power or greater power because of their numbers as far as government?
Well, it's nice to think so, but I'm afraid that Peru is like every other Latin American country. I should say the present president of Peru is of native background, Toledo, his name is, but he's unique. As you may know, in Bolivia, a native leader has just been elected president. He takes office in a week or two, I believe, and that's really unusual. But if you look almost everywhere in Latin America, you find a majority native population, but this small white elite runs the country. They own everything. They run the government. And it's true. Mexico, Guatemala, Nicaragua, all the way down, you know, through Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, Paraguay, all those countries, you have a majority population of people of color, but you have a white elite that runs the country, owns the industry, runs the government, and it's very unusual when you find any exception. In fact, Toledo, who's the present president of Peru, he may be of indigenous background, but really he does not represent the indigenous people. What's interesting about the new president of Bolivia is that he does represent the indigenous people, and people like the American government are not happy with this. They don't want an outsider. They don't want a minority person. You know, they want somebody they can control, you know, a member of the club, right? And this guy in Bolivia is not a member of the club, and he's a trade unionist and the head of the coca growers union, like coca leaves. And this is too hard for people. So we'll see what happens in Bolivia once he takes power. But that's very unusual. So the bottom line is that the indigenous people have more say in things than they used to have. if you'd like, things are a little bit more democratic than they used to be, but still, you know, when push comes to shove, you know, that you have an elite that kind of runs things. And the average, you know, well, I mean, you say the same thing is true in Canada, right? I mean, who runs Canada, right? It's not working people, really, you know.
It's not Indigenous people here.
No. Certainly not Indigenous people here, yeah.
I wonder, many of them move from their small villages into the city, I suppose. And do they have a homelessness problem with
Yeah, them? There's huge problems. There's huge suburbs in Lima, like, that have no electricity, no running water. This in the city. There are large parts of the city that have no running water, no electricity. People move into the outskirts of the city and they build little mud huts, you know, out of mud bricks or out of sticks and things. And they just sort of set up camp there and a little, you know, township will arise around it and so on. And eventually the city will provide some electricity and so on, but they can't keep up with it because it keeps happening all the time.
And are people leaving the land because they're being basically kicked off the land because of larger holding and industrialization of agriculture? Is it?
Well, I think it's a complicated situation, but it is a problem of population growth and how much the land can hold. It is a problem of management as well. Peru is a bit on, they had a land reform about 30 years ago. And at that time, a lot of the big landowners were taken over by the government and the land and cooperatives were set up. And a lot of the indigenous people actually at that time who had been basically slaves on the land until 30 years ago, were able to get some control over land and in these cooperatives. Since then though, there's been some right-wing governments that have moved towards trying to force the cooperatives to sell off the small packages of land. So, you once again get the problem with small landholders. And then there's not enough land for the children to divide up amongst themselves, right? And so people are forced off the land because there just isn't enough land for them.
Mm-hmm. I guess with all that poverty, other species don't get a lot of attention as far as welfare and animal rights.
Yeah, one of the interesting things is when you travel up into the mountains, as soon as you start getting up a certain level, up above, 10,000-12,000 feet, you're starting to get into the Altiplano and into the areas where there's high bogs and small lakes and so on, especially up around 12,000 feet, you all of a sudden start running into alpacas and llamas, which are indigenous animals, the cameloids, and there's lots and lots of them. It's interesting that these were, of course, domesticated by the indigenous people thousands of years ago, and they still are largely controlled by indigenous people who own small herds of alpacas and llamas. And the alpaca particularly are kept for the wool, right? Alpaca wool is great in demand. Also vicuñas are one area we went through which is very interesting. They're wild vicuñas. The vicuña is another relative of the alpaca and the llama, but vicuñas are protected by the government, and you run into certain parts of the country, there are actually wild vicuñas, and we traveled to this area and they were running around, these wild vicuñas, which are the size of a medium-sized deer, say, with lovely brown fur on them, wool on them. And what happens is that people get licenses so they can go and they can trap the vicuñas and shear the wool off them and let them go. So on the one hand, this is a problem for these vicuñas because they end up getting trapped. But on the other hand, the government is very rigid about nobody harming the vicuñas. Because they are in danger, well, they're in danger, but there's not many left, and so they are left alone in the countryside.
Would they naturally shed their wool every year? That maybe it could be found rather than taken.
Good question. I don't know if they do.
I imagine they shear them at the proper time of year because they are in the mountains, are they?
Yeah,
so
quite high up.
Pretty cold, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
pretty cold.
Now the looming global warming is quite a threat to the agriculture in Peru because of they get most of their water in the summer from the melting glaciers, and if those glaciers disappear, they don't quite know what's going to happen.
Yeah, in different parts of the country, water presents different types of problems because there is some rainfall in the mountains, and some of the mountainous areas actually get enough water. But then in the areas that depend on the runoff, like from the glaciers, and so the rivers that run down to the coast that depend on ultimately on glacial runoff, there's a big potential problem there.
I guess,
sure.
Alan, this has been most interesting, and I thank you for it.
I just wanted to mention, in terms of wildlife, it was worth mentioning this. What you mentioned right off the top, the national park we visited south of Lima. Mm-hmm. And the park is the Paracas Park. It's probably, I don't know, it's about a 4 or 5 hour drive south of Lima. And Paracas was originally, well, it's this total desert. It's this peninsula. And it's archaeologically important because there was this very high civilization there about 2,000 years ago. But just off the peninsula, there's this small group of islands called the Islas Ballestas. And the Peruvians like to call the Islas Ballestas the small Galapagos. And so when we were down there, we took a boat out to these islands. And it was the most amazing wildlife experiences I've had. I've had a few amazing ones, but these islands are just incredibly rich in wildlife. There were birds everywhere. I've never seen anything quite like it, like these small to medium-sized islands were simply covered with birds. There was hundreds of thousands of cormorants and boobies, and the penguins. I'd never seen wild penguins before. Along the shore of these islands, it's a cold current there, right, that comes up from Antarctica. And so there are penguins that breed there, as well as all these cormorants and gulls and boobies. And thousands of sea lions, thousands of them around the beaches of these islands. And the whole place was really quite a spectacular thing. And it's very good that the Peruvian government has set this aside as a national reserve, and you're not even allowed to set foot on the islands. You can take a boat out, and the boat just kind of takes you around, and it gets quite close. You can get good looks at these animals, but you can't go ashore. But it's something worth mentioning, and for anybody who's thinking of going to Peru, they should absolutely have it. It's easy to get to from Lima. Any hotel can find you a tour bus that will take you down there for a couple of days, and it's easy to get there, and it's well worth doing.
Is there an area for tourist accommodation right near it?
Yes, there is.
And then you go by boat out and
Island. We stayed in a town about, I don't know, 10 or 15 miles away, and then early in the morning a little tour bus came and took us down and loaded us on a boat, and then we went out around there for a few hours on the boat, and then in the afternoon they picked us up in the bus again and took us over to this peninsula to drive around the desert on the peninsula, which was also very interesting. Mm-hmm. A completely other, different sort of environment, but fascinating, too. Mm,
sounds fascinating.
Is that a source of guano, Peru?
It is. You're right. Yeah, actually, that's right. These islands are famous because of the seabirds there, the vast, vast numbers of seabirds that are there all year round. These islands, hundreds of years ago, were discovered to be sources of guano. And in fact,
cliff sides are full of really essentially dirt dropping.
That's right. Yes, yes.
Well, thank you again, Alan, for that. You have been listening to an interview with Alan Jensen, who was telling us about his recent trip to Peru. Now, Alan, could we have a little bit of music, please?
Listening to Animal Voices on Co-op Radio, 102.7 FM in Vancouver. Now, people shop at the body shop because they think that the body shop sells cosmetics and toiletries that are free of animal testing. Well, it's not really true. It seems that the body shop is funding animal experiments in AIDS research by funding a group of people who call themselves CANFAR, which is Canadian Association for AIDS Research. Hang on a minute. the Canadian Foundation for AIDS Research. And just to set the scene, because animal experimentation is sometimes thought of as a strictly animal welfare or animal rights issue, which it is not. Of course, it's also a medical issue, and that's how the researchers argue their case, because they say, well, we need animal research. It's maybe an ethical problem, but we need it and therefore can't do without it because it's scientifically valid. Of course, many medical authorities have disputed that claim and said exactly the opposite, that it is misleading and scientifically worthless. For example, Professor Pietro Croce, who's a medical doctor and an internationally trained researcher and physician, visiting lecturer at the University of Milan, in a book that he wrote in 1985 called Vivisection or Science, A Choice to be Made. And he said, I carried out animal experiments over many years following an unsound logic which had been drummed into me during my studies at the university and a long time afterwards. Until one day I said to myself, something must be wrong in the thinking and practice of medicine, something basic, meaning the method is totally wrong. It would be very difficult to find anything that could be more misleading for biomedical research than animal experimentation. And a countryman of his, parliamentarian, Italian parliamentarian Gianno Tamino, was also a researcher at the University of Padua, which is the most important medical university in Italy, stated his view in an interview with an Italian magazine on December 1st, 1984, and he said, as a researcher, I'm involved with mutagenesis and cancerogenesis, two areas in which experimentation is fundamentally indispensable. I therefore know what I'm talking about, and I say no to animal experimentation, not only on ethical, but above all on scientific grounds. It's been proven that the results of research with animals are in no case valid for man. There's a law of nature in relation to metabolism according to which a biochemical reaction that one has established in one species only applies to that species and not to any other. Two closely related species like the mouse and the rat often react entirely differently. And he says it isn't merely a matter of humane concern in regard to other living beings, but much rather a more correct choice from the scientific point of view than animal experimentation, which can rarely be significant because of the animal's different metabolism and other characteristics that human beings have. Animal experiments is very often just senseless speculation and cruelty, which don't guarantee in any way that the sought-after result will be obtained, while at the same time involving enormous expenditures and other methods based on the usage of cells cultured in vitro, that is in glass, based on biological systems in vitro, provide much greater economy, quicker answers, and thanks to technological refinement, more reliable results, more likely to be extrapolated to human beings. So we're asked to make a choice which is coherent with the progress of biology and to refuse a method that evokes medieval barbarity and certainly not any experimentation done for the sake of prevention and an increase of the quality of human life. Well, somebody brought to the attention of readers of Animals Canada News Group on Yahoo, and that on the Body Shop Canada website, it clearly states that they're against animal testing within the cosmetics and toiletries industries. Well, that seems to let them off the hook and allows them to believe in animal testing in industry or medicine, it seems. And a writer writes in to the group that she wants to forward a letter which she received from CanFar, which is the Canadian Foundation for AIDS Research. She says, I always shop at the Body Shop as they are listed with PETA as one of the animal-friendly companies around for vegan shoppers. I was in downtown Vancouver a few weeks back and I noticed some trendy bracelets that the Body Shop was selling. I did more research into this and the bracelets are to fund CanFar for AIDS research. So I decided to write a letter to both the Body Shop as well as to CanFar. The Body Shop is always professing they are against animal testing, and this very same store that the bracelets were being sold at had a huge sign out front that clearly said, against animal testing. Basically, the Body Shop is saying they're against animal testing, yet they're also selling bracelets which will give money to AIDS research, which, as per this email from CanFar, will probably go to animal testing. So this email is just for your information if you decide to inclined to write to the Body Shop and CanFar for yourselves or boycott the Body Shop altogether. So she wrote a handwritten letter to the Body Shop head office in the UK, and they emailed me and said that my letter had been passed along to the appropriate people and that they will be getting back to me. At this point, it's clear that they don't think this through, that they haven't thought this through, and I made sure I told them so in my letter. I, too, support AIDS research, but not at the expense of millions of animals. And here is the letter from CANFAR, which is Canadian Foundation for AIDS Research. Thank you for your interest in the Canadian Foundation for AIDS Research. The primary goal of our foundation is to raise money for research into all aspects of HIV infection and AIDS. As primarily a funding body, CANFAR does not control the specifics of any of the research products, projects that we fund. However, researchers are expected to adhere to the ethical standards put forth by the institutions at which they are based. CANFAR asserts that the medical research we fund is designed to save lives and works toward ending a deadly disease faced by millions. And while CANFAR in no way condones the gratuitous use of animal testing, we do acknowledge that medical research does, at times, require the use of animals as test subjects. Should you have any further questions about the Canadian Foundation for AIDS Research, please do not hesitate to contact me. So there you are. Medical authorities claim that animal research is totally useless. Others, of course, claim that it is useful and indispensable. And here we have the Body Shop investing in the Canadian Foundation for AIDS Research, which uses animals in research. It just shows you how shallow people's thinking can be.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that, John. Now, I have a little story. Perhaps this will be the end of our show, I think. It's a very short one, and it's about a very sensitive dog. It's called Compassion of Noodles, and it comes from a book called God's Messenger, and the author is Judy Talibom. Compassion should be my dog Noodle's given name. A female black Labrador mix, she has an extraordinary sense about when people are in need and moves towards them with all the love she can muster. People always know that Noodle's cares for them by the loving look in her soulful brown eyes. I first noticed Noodle's compassion when she was a puppy. I gave a party for 30 volunteers from our local AIDS project. Noodle spent the evening going back and forth among the three people who were ill with AIDS. When I took her to the HIV/AIDS support group I lead, Noodle spent 2 hours every week lying on various clients' laps. If a member of the group seemed particularly upset, she would stay with that person all evening. Noodle became my co-leader. Soon Noodle also became my co-therapist. A 17-year-old girl, Sally, came to me for psychotherapy. She'd witnessed a very disturbing, fatal incident of family violence. I had never before worked with anyone in the immediate aftermath of such a devastating experience. When Sally arrived at my office, I ushered her towards the sofa. Noodles followed. Sally sat down. Noodles, who isn't allowed on the furniture, immediately crawled up on Sally and lay across her lap, like a warm, furry blanket. I was startled and almost told Noodles to get down, but then I saw Sally smile and pet the dog. Noodles spent much of the session looking up into Sally's face and licking her. Noodles stayed with Sally for the whole hour and for every subsequent therapy session with her. Later I found out that Sally had several pets of her own and loved dogs. I was never sure how much I helped Sally, but I knew that Noodle's love and support made a huge difference in the teenager's healing. Since then, I noticed that whenever Noodle sees someone who is in pain, she licks them and stays by their side. She contributes to my client's recovery in ways that no one else ever could. Now, there's a wonderful dog, and aren't they all? Thanks very much for listening to Animal Voices today, our first show of the new year. And please tune in again next Friday, 12 noon, and we will be back here. If you would like to recommend the program to somebody else, it is replayed Mondays 4 to 5 p.m. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.